Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
They're harvesting adrenochrome from children and doing satanic rituals, and they're gonna turn your kids gay or whatever it is now that they're worried about.
I hope so.
don't tell them about the agenda.
Yeah. I'm dyking out, you're dyking out. Let's dyke out together. See what it's all about.
Dyking out, dyking out, dyking out.
Hi, and welcome to Dyking Out, the Gamergate of podcasts, as in G-A-Y-M-E-R, but spelling that out doesn't make it make sense. So I'm Carolyn Bergier.
I'm Melody Kamali, and today we're dyking out with video essayist Natalie Wynn, who many of you know as ContraPoints.
Hello.
I am so excited. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Natalie.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Such a dumb intro that I wrote for us.
Gamergate?
Gamergate, yeah. I'm like,
we're putting
whatever.
The gate in Gamergate.
Yeah. Yes. Mm. Even though I'm still not
Carolyn.
Quite sure of all the nuances of Gamergate. I know. I'm
not sure I want to do that. I'm not sure I
no.
want the gay in Gamergate. I think I want the Mergate out.
Yes.
Yeah. There's still time to change it. Do a little
okay.
pickup.
No announcements this week.
No announcements. We're very excited and we want to get into it. Natalie. Yeah. I am in a parasocial relationship with you. I am obsessed. I told Carolyn a couple years ago, like in lockdown, that we should have you on the podcast because that's around the time I started binging your videos. But I wanted to wait and give it some distance because I felt too familiar with you and I didn't want to feel weird or make you feel weird. So I let my obsession breathe a little bit and we're doing it.
I'm sure we're all in parasocial relationships with each other.
Yes.
Yeah. Now that you got that confession out of the way,
I have
Melody.
To. Word vomit up top. Let's get to the gayest thing.
Yeah.
Carolyn, what's the gayest thing you did this week?
The gayest thing I did this week. Okay. The gayest thing I did this week, I am in Montreal right now. And Montreal is known for having amazing food. So I've been going out to eat, taking pictures of the food and wanting to be really basic and post it on Instagram and post it on my stories. But I stopped myself for the vegans who follow me, the queer vegans.
That's very queer.
I don't want to trigger them. So the gayest thing I did this week was held back on posting photos of like these like delicious dishes that I know people would get really upset if they saw them in my feed. So I'm sparing your eyes from that as a vegan ally. I think if I were a vegan ally, I would just go vegan. I know, but I don't want to trick anyone into thinking I'm a good person. So I'm not vegan for the time being.
Great.
Melody, what's the gayest thing you did this week?
I'm going to have to say I had our listeners in mind with, and our followers as well, with my gayest thing. I have a sinus infection right now. Maybe that's why I came in hot. I'm like, I feel like I'm on crack. I'm on Sudafed, but it I feel manic.
The good stuff.
And yeah, the locked up stuff. And
we've all been there with feeling manic on Sudafed. They do,
I forgot
they use
about
it to
that.
Make meth, right?
Yeah, that's why it's locked up.
Yeah. But I posted that I had a sinus infection, and so many queer people reached out and told me to get a neti pot, which I've been asked to do by my mother for so long. But I finally ordered one and it came. I did it. I don't know. Neti pots feel queer to me. Maybe it's because everyone and my mom who reads gay has suggested it. I feel like it's self-care. It's queer. I'm grasping for something this week. I've otherwise been in bed. Count it. I did rewatch your shame video, Natalie. That one is pretty gay.
Yeah, so. That's one of the gayest things I've ever done.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. Well, what's the gayest thing you did this week?
The gayest thing I did this week, I was attracted to a woman. we can do better. I bought a new crystal. I don't have any understanding of the metaphysical properties of crystals, but I do like them. I'm attracted to the inherent shininess of them, and there's like a growing number of them on my windowsill. So
same.
I guess because I've mostly just been locked in my house doing video editing, so I guess that's the gayest thing I've gotten into.
Yeah, I think to like persevere through video editing, you need the energy from the crystals.
Well, I like to think so. You know, the moonlight kind of cleanses them on the windowsill, and I feel like that's really charging this entire video project.
Yes. I would have thought from the aesthetics of your videos that you have been like into crystals for a long time. There's something very like magical. Yes.
I've always liked crystals. I used to kind of, I had like a big, like weird collection when I was a child. And now I have like the funds to make it more, even more unreasonably out of control. So the crystal habit is well funded. I shouldn't say crystal habit when we're talking about Sudafed, but, you know, this amethyst. I just got a shungite pyramid. I don't know what that means, but it's very cool looking.
Where do you get your crystals from? Is there like a local purveyor?
There's a crystal dealer in Baltimore, but I also get a lot of them online.
Yeah,
I only want to talk about crystals in terms of like illicit dealings.
There's a lot of Etsy shops that that do crystals.
Okay.
So. Yeah, I got one for my birthday from an Etsy shop for my sister, and I looked it up because I had the shop name. They are so expensive. These crystals.
It's an expensive habit.
Yeah, I was at a comedy festival in Portland. We went to a crystal shop and one of the comics I was with was kind of buzzed, and we were walking out and she had stolen this massive crystal that must have been hundreds. I don't know. It was huge. I don't know how she did it. And I was like, how is that like good karma? How is there good energy this from this
cartoonish crime?
I know.
stealing a giant crystal.
Yeah. Unless she's planning on like reselling it and getting the money, she's in a bind. I was like, you got to get rid of that. You got to take that back. That's bad juju.
Yes.
There's for like sure. a lesser known Disney movie from the 70s called The Rescuers, which has a queer coded villain who kidnaps a little girl and sends her down into a well to retrieve this like gigantic diamond out of the eye of a skull.
I forgot all about the plot of that.
The crystals are very heavily involved, if I remember rightly.
I love that. I do think crystals are very queer, and my wife's family, I think, to like show their acceptance of our marriage, even though they're like Peruvian and Catholic, they sent us like just this large amethyst as like a gift. And I'm like, oh, I think they probably Googled like, what do lesbians like? And it was like crystals. It just seemed like such a random thing. We loved it. Obviously we welcomed it into our home, but Yeah. There should be some type of like official gift guide to lesbian. It probably for lesbians probably exists.
Shiny locks is usually pretty safe.
Yeah.
It's like the Bath and Body Works for queer people.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Natalie, so you've been making a new video
for about 6 months. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. How long do these take from like planning to shooting, editing?
Well, it seems like it takes longer every time. And I keep promising myself, okay, we're going to go back to the way it used to be. I'm going to go back to 30-minute videos that I was able to do once every month or two. But once you get in the habit of making these like 90-minute epics, it's hard to go back. And I can't seem to control myself. So, I mean, the current project I'm working on, this is my self-care move. I've decided to split it into part one and part two. But that does mean that after like 7 to 8 months of absence, I'm going to show up with a part one, which I hope people aren't mad about. But I don't know, like Marvel does this with their movies. So like, right. Why can't YouTubers do it?
Oh,
right,
please.
Right.
The longer, the better. I am into it and I'm very much looking forward to it.
But yeah, it takes me almost a month just to edit it. So... you know, the filming is usually a week or two. That's the fastest part, honestly. Writing, I'm so bad at writing. I mean, I don't want to say I'm bad at it, but I find it really difficult. I don't like writing. I procrastinate all day. I don't know. I just find it torturous.
Yeah.
Are you mostly like really sticking to script when you're doing these, or do sometimes you go off on a little bit of a inspired tangent?
I try to keep it a sort of mix. I would say that most of it, 90%+ is scripted, but I feel that, you know, when you're doing a YouTube video to an audience, or people call them video essays, but I'm still putting my face on the camera. I'm looking into the camera, like I'm talking to you, that as is the YouTube style. And so in order for that to feel authentic, for it to not just feel, because sometimes when people try to do this kind of video and they're just starting out and they sort of haven't, I mean, even when I was first starting out, I was like this. It sounds too much like they wrote an essay for school and they're sitting there reading it. But you don't want that. That's not the energy you want. The energy you want is like, oh, this person's just speaking to you. You're talking. It used to feel very casual. And the one way to give it that feeling is to kind of improvise some stuff as you do it, and to kind of like, when I film a video, I'll just kind of talk to myself for like 2 minutes before I even start doing the script. Like a lot of it's just like nonsense. Like I'll just be saying like nonsensical things to the camera, or just like making cat noises, or just anything to kind of get into this like flow of like sort of non robotic speaking. Cause I just don't want to feel like I'm reading someone an essay.
Right. And it obviously doesn't come off that way at all. It just feels like so natural and great.
Thank you.
Yeah. I just realized I called you a video essayist up top, and I had YouTuber originally. I didn't know what do you prefer, because I didn't know if YouTuber was not
a slur.
I know.
I mean, I like when other people can call me video essayists, but I call myself a YouTuber. I don't know, calling yourself a video essayist, it's kind of like, I'm an artist. You know, it's better to let other people decide if you're that. And it's not, you know.
She's an artist.
She's an artist. It's high art.
She's an artist.
I'm a YouTuber, yeah. I mean, YouTuber is a stigmatized, like, well, YouTubers have like not really, you know, made an attractive public image for ourselves as a group, I think, at this point. But I don't know. To me, I'm entertained by like the low expectations set.
YouTuber. Right. It's like telling people you're a podcaster. It could be anything.
It's very similar.
Yeah.
Yes. The range of quality and topics and unhingedness.
Yeah. The range of quality.
But we're not going to call ourselves audio lecturers or professional conversationalists. I don't know.
Social commentator. Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
So for any of our listeners who aren't familiar with you, can you talk about your humble YouTube origins and how you got from there to having, you know, over a million and a half subscribers?
Sure. Yeah. I started making videos. I started taking it seriously in 2016. And I guess originally I was making videos about politics. This was like back in, 2016, it feels like three decades ago.
Right.
But this was, you know, Barack Obama was president, Donald Trump was running for president. And originally the topic of the channel was kind of this like rising, like far right backlash movement, which was really prominent online at the time. Like no one was really taking it seriously offline. Like I can remember like spring, summer 2016, having these conversations with people where I was really worried about what was at the time called the alt-right and this kind of like neo-fascist, like reactionary, misogynist thing that was happening. And then people who didn't look at the internet just had no idea what I was talking about. And they're like, what do you mean? We have a black president. Hillary's going to be president next. Like how bad could it be? Well,
yeah.
I don't know. I feel that the 2016 internet was just like a series of canaries in the coal mine. So that was the topic. Over time, I've kind of done videos about all kinds of things. I'm a trans woman, and I've kind of transitioned since 2016, progressively kind of in public on YouTube, which is not a good idea. I don't recommend doing that, but I did it, and you know that's part of the history of the channel. So there's no going back. I talk about LGBT issues. I talk about psychology. I don't know. I have sort of an academic background. I was, before I decided to move to the more prestigious YouTube world, I was a PhD student. I was getting a PhD in philosophy, but I just couldn't. I don't know. Being an academic is not for me. I couldn't. It's just a personality mismatch.
I'm also a PhD dropout, so we're kind of the same.
Oh yeah,
It's a good not philosophy, but you quickly get in and realize that everything's bullshit. At least that was my experience. Yeah. That I was like, oh, none of this is real. And it's just all like a weird academic circle jerk. And I cannot imagine doing this for the rest of my life and pretending to care.
It's such an alarming realization of higher education when you like have to like reckon with the fact that there's just idiots at every level of education and power in this world. And it's like, oh, there's no adults.
Yeah. Yeah, I know an idiot with two doctorates, actually.
Yeah. Oh, there's so many of them. It's
bizarre. Your videos have obviously like grown in popularity. It really speaks to how popular they are when you can just name something shame or envy and not have to worry about the SE or like being topical, I guess. Has there been an evolution in like your, I don't know, strategy and trying to get that traction? Because it doesn't seem like you need to be strategic at all anymore with your following.
For sure. I mean, when I first started out, I think I did need to make video titles that were sort of, we're going to bring in new viewers because they're not going to write, the channel's called ContraPoints. If you haven't heard of ContraPoints, you know, you're not going to click on it because of that. But I feel like, well, it's almost like a weird flex at this point is to give like your videos anti-clickbait titles, like where the video will just be called Shame or Envy or something, which like that is, you know, on a website where you're competing with like, I tested how many drops of blood a shark would come attack me with, or I'm sure we all watched that video or like whatever. Like it's, story time. Like, I don't know. I guess at this point I'm relying on the fact that enough people are sort of in the habit of watching my videos that they'll watch a video I make, even if the title sounds boring.
We're into it. I mean, you've referenced your subreddit in your videos. And I was curious, do you dive in there? Like, it only came to mind because I'm thinking of just how popular you are. And, you know, there's a very active subreddit dedicated to the channel. Do you look at that, squinting? And
I occasionally still check in. I think I kind of decided at some point it's not really the healthiest thing to be reading about yourself all day.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's definitely tempting, right? I think that being a kind of public figure, I'm sure you've grappled with this too, being a public figure online or someone that has an audience, like it's kind of like being granted this superpower to overhear what everyone is thinking about you, which right. is at once like kind of horrifying, but also really tempting. Like, right. because you, I don't know, you want to know what people are saying about you. That's just, I feel like the inherent human curiosity. You want to know what people think about you. But once there's a kind of limitless supply of opinions, like you can really overdose on with a kind of bad habit, I think. So I try not to spend too much time reading what people say, although I still do a lot of it.
Yeah.
I read YouTube comments, which everyone says not to do, but I don't know. I want to know what people are saying.
I know.
Well, I think like a lot of times too, we talked about this a little bit in a recent episode with Dylan Marin, who does Conversations with People Who Hate Me. And I think a lot of times people will say like hurtful or mean or like very critical things, but not actually mean them. And if you were ever to push back a little bit and be like, oh, do you seriously think I'm like a toad face whore? Well, like whatever it is that they're saying, like they'd be like, oh, actually, no, I don't think that. Like, I was just having a bad day or like something done. You're like, oh, okay. Then why'd you write this like really mean thing? But like when he would ask people that were saying that he was like, just this like awful, stupid, ugly homosexual, and they'd be like, no, actually, like, you're very handsome, and like like, I don't have a problem with gay people, I was just angry by like one little thing you said.
Yeah, there's a lot of like free form aggression kind of floating around online, and you do
right
make yourself a magnet for it when you know, and it's not like evenly distributed. Like if right. if you're a woman, it's worse. If you're queer, it's worse. If you're not white, it's worse. Like there's, you know, so I guess I'm a little bit reluctant to just dismiss this always. Oh, it's just trolls. Yeah, that's kind of true. But also I think it has a sort of disproportionate effect on certain people.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I for mean, sure.
Like on the dating apps, I remember when I was yeah. hetero curious and trying to mm-hmm. date men for the first time and getting on OkCupid, I would get very racist. Like Durka Durka Jihad, one guy sent me once. And every time yeah. something like that happened, I would start to say, walk me through that thought process behind that message. And they literally would. They're like, I see you're Middle Eastern, even though you look more Paki, in my opinion. And it reminded me of
South Park. Oh, an intellectual.
Yeah. Like really thought he did something. Like, that's my new thing with angry, like, DMs. Like, walk me through this.
Yeah, it reminds me of how like Twitter now has this feature where if you type, I don't know what keywords will trigger this, but if you type a really aggressive tweet, Twitter will post, will pop up a little message that says like, are you sure you want to tweet this? Like,
really?
yeah, which I think is great. But I do wonder when people send messages like that, like, I don't know, do they think, is it just, you're right that, yeah, dating men on the apps, it's like, yeah, just scraping the bottom. Yeah.
Yeah. Barnacles.
Speaking of criticism, in your cancellation video, which I love and I recommend everybody watch it, what's with the anime of it all? Like, why why is every avatar, and we get that too, like
and we genuinely like talked most about this and wondered out loud.
Yeah, our most negative ones. Yeah. It's always an anime avatar, so we're like,
yeah,
it's been, and we're afraid to talk about this right now on the record. I think we have brought it up and edited it out, but we need to get to the bottom of this.
Oh, why is it anime profile pictures? Well, I think that I mean there's the element of that it's anonymous, right? Like that's
sure.
sort of basic, like anonymity empowers people to have not just not face any accountability or responsibility for the things they say, but also to have subjectively a sense of the like that this has not attached to their public persona in any way, and so almost maybe it's not even attached to themselves, right? They're able to act in ways that they ordinarily wouldn't. Why anime? Yeah, that's really an eternal mystery. I don't know. I think
it's just not fit. It doesn't seem fair to anime or fans of anime that yeah. like that they're like characters are being hijacked to form these mobs to cancel
It's like the full political spectrum too. Like you'll get like Nazi anime avatars. You'll right. get like, I don't know, like angry queer teenagers who are anime avatars. Right. It's like, it's everything. And I don't know why, but the most aggressive people all have some kind of like uwu anime girl. It's, I don't know.
Yeah. The colorful, like the images are so bright and bouncy and colorful and always paired with the most hateful shit. I get genuinely nervous when I see an anime avatar now at this point.
It's like it triggers this like limbic system, like clenching, like, oh God, what's here comes, like, you know what I mean? Like it's this trauma response to seeing, the most innocent cartoon characters. Yeah. It's
what did Sailor Moon do? To deserve. That's my only reference. I have no frame of reference, actually. But I see it a lot.
I know that you've had to do a lot of, or not that you've had to, but you've chosen to do a lot of apologizing based on certain backlash. Have you ever regretted apologizing? I know in real life, like even just normal things, nothing having to do with being canceled, where somebody will be like, you upset me, you did this, and you're like, oh, I'm sorry, and then later you're like, wait a minute, I didn't need to apologize.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of bad faith criticism online. I don't actually regret apologizing for anything. I don't know. I feel that my perspective has actually shifted a bit since I made the video about canceling. I mean, I still agree with especially the first half of that video. A lot of what I said was basically an analysis of the kind of weaponization of like social justice accusations as a way to bully people, which is like a very common for like, this is like teenagers on Tumblr have been doing this to each other for 10 years. Yeah. You know, you use it as basically, it's just a kind of morally, seemingly moral way of bullying people, right? Is you like assemble this like list of every little transgression they've ever committed and you use it to basically say they're a horrible person, and that justifies you treating them however badly you want to. I don't know. I try to be careful with this because it's so easy to kind of appropriate like this language. I think if I were to remake the canceling video now, I probably would have not called it canceling. I would have come up with some new term because it's so easy for people to kind of take your critique of the bullying side of this and to turn it into like, oh, the woke cancel culture mob on Twitter with their blue check marks is silencing me and you can't say everyone anymore. I was just sitting here innocently trying to talk about the supremacy of the white race and all these woke ideologues, blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
So like, I guess I'm... It makes it hard to talk about when people actually are kind of misusing the strategies of like of social media accountability to basically do ostracism and shunning in a very like high school kind of way. But you know, I don't know. I guess when I say that my perspective has changed since I did that video, I guess having a couple years now to kind of cool off and sort of detach and watch other people go through the similar kinds of experiences is that it's just sort of inevitable that if you are visible, if you have a high profile, you're gonna attract criticism and there's gonna be haters and there's gonna be people who, you know, misunderstand you and there's gonna be people who lie about you. And I don't know. I feel like I've watched people kind of be destroyed by their obsession with setting the record straight and responding to the haters and feeling like they need to constantly be out there defending themselves. It's almost like a mindfulness meditation kind of thing that I've developed of just practicing letting go and just letting people lie about me and just like letting it pass.
Right.
Because it's never going to stop. And I think that getting obsessed with it and constantly trying to clarify, constantly trying to defend yourself, well, for one thing, it often only just makes your critics more visible, right? Like you sort of allow your public persona and what people see is what you're tweeting or what you're posting. So if all you're tweeting about, all you're posting about is your haters and your critics, then all people are seeing is hatred and criticism of you. And then I also just think that this kind of tendency to be defensive about criticism can, I don't know, I've seen it turn people into, like, even if they weren't necessarily, like, hateful people to begin with, they sort of become hateful people, right? Like I don't know, J.K. Rowling, when she first started tweeting about trans people, I don't know if she hated trans people in 2018, but she definitely does now.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is that she, because she, you know, people get sucked into this obsession with their critics.
Right.
Yeah. I love that you call her Joanne on the J.K. Rowling video, by the way. And I've since started calling her Joanne.
Yes.
Yeah. I feel like that's really caught on. I feel like I see a lot of people calling her Joanne now.
I love that. No, the same thing happened, and granted, like a very different issue, but I feel like Louis C.K. like really pivoted to become like performing for alt-right audiences, and like now all of his fans, it's so different than what it was before, because the criticism, like, he got so defensive about it that he was just kind of like a big middle finger to everyone who, you know, had a problem with what he did with his, like, predatory behavior, and leaned in the other way. And it's like, oh, that sucks even more.
Yeah, I feel like I've in the last few years, I feel like I've watched this happen again and again and again, where a person does something bad, or they, or sometimes they don't even do something that's that bad, but then they get so obsessed with their critics and so obsessed with needing to constantly fight back against what they perceive as this, like, oppressive mob, that it becomes like their defining thing. And
I guess
watching that has made me really kind of, like, introspect and just be kind of conscious of that as something to guard against in myself. Like, I have friends I've told, like, don't let me ever be like this. Like, please,
right.
we need like a safe word. Like, if I'm starting to act like, if I'm starting to act like Dave Chappelle, please, like, throw a bucket of water on me or something.
Oh,
like,
God. Yeah.
Don't let me be one of these people who gets so obsessed with, no, actually, I'm not wrong. It's everyone else is wrong. And I'm, it's so unfair the way this mob is coming from me. Like, I don't know. It's like a third of all public figures. Now that's the only thing they talk about. It's a social media disease.
Are you ready to shop? Rakuten's Big Give Week is back. Get 15% back at hundreds of stores, and it's all happening this week, May 6th to May 13th. It's the perfect time to shop for everything on your list for spring and summer, like clothing, outdoor gear, and travel. I know I'm using this week to stock up on some warmer weather essentials at Ray-Ban and Ulta, and I love that Rakuten even helps me save on travel at sites like hotels.com. Rakuten really is the best way to shop, and you can save even more by stacking cash back on top of deals. Plus, during Big Give Week, that cash back is bigger than ever. With Rakuten, membership is free, and when you sign up and shop today, you get an extra 10% cash back boost. That's an extra 10% cash back on top of the 15% cash back. You won't see higher cash back rates than these. Go to Rakuten.com or download the Rakuten app. R-A-K-U-T-E-N. Shoppers get it. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
But that, right. It feels like, too, though, that, like, you can't win. Like, as, like, as a content creator, like, you can't win if people, you know, say stuff about you, if you defend yourself, if you don't. And then it's like, there's always going to be, like, you can never say the right apology that's going to appease. Like, did you notice from, I guess, a numbers standpoint, because with your Patreon, I guess you actually have, like, data points on cancellation, right? Like, yes. After people got mad, you could see, like, how much it dropped off. And then after you spoke about it and broke it down, like, did it go back up? Like, I know it's not an exact science, but
I think this is actually an important thing to talk about, because I think it really contextualizes the level of outrage that people have about cancel culture. So I have never gotten a bigger boost in Patreon support than after I made the canceling video. Some people will say that I did it on purpose. Oh, this is all, you know, my grift, right? Is
to can't
the,
win.
The grift tweets. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is to play the victim and therefore to get support. No, I didn't intentionally do that, but someone could intentionally do that. And I do think it's worth keeping an eye on the fact that, I don't know, I actually feel conflicted about this myself. Sometimes I look at the, you know, the boost of support I got from that, and I'm like, I don't know if that's actually the reason I want to be supported. Like, I feel like it's kind of like, I'm being attacked by the radical left, like, blood money in a way. I do appreciate, right, that people, like, want to show, like, support of someone who's, like, been the target of, like, a massive, like, you know, ostracism and shunning harassment kind of campaign, which I think I was. I have, you know, hundreds and hundreds of tweets documenting it. Like, but I think that, a lot of times this, you know, the social media outrage, especially if you're already an established public figure, I think it sort of doesn't materialize consequences as much as it does actually for someone who isn't a public figure. Like, I don't know. I've seen people on a smaller level can lose their jobs because their workplace is being harassed and things like that. That actually concerns me more, I think, than like, this YouTuber is being mistreated, which YouTubers are mistreated, and that sucks. But, you know, I try to have a perspective about it.
Yeah.
Do you have any incels in your Patreon that work their way in there to, like, cross enemy lines?
Do I have incels? I think a lot of, you know, especially back in like 2018, a lot of the kind of audience that I was building at the time was a kind of like de-radicalized audience. Like, I guess, I mean, here's another thing I have mixed feelings about now. A lot of the audience that I built back in 2017, 2018, it was men who I had kind of talked away from the edge of whatever, like, reactionary, like, misogynistic backlash movement they were about to join. I think that it's a skill is to be able to kind of talk to men about issues like feminism or like, you know, trans rights, gay rights, in a way that doesn't make them feel attacked. And that's really the trick, isn't it? When oftentimes the mere mention of these topics will make people feel attacked. So right. If you can talk to them in a way that doesn't make them feel as threatened, and yet still, like, willing to listen to the point of, you know, actually internalizing some of it, well, it's kind of an important sweet spot. I think that the downside of it is that if someone is kind of on the cusp of some kind of reactionary, bigoted ideology, it's not something that disappears overnight. And so there is like a little bit of discomfort I have sometimes with certain portions of my own fan base that I think are like not as de-radicalized as they think they are.
Okay. Yeah.
And sometimes it comes out in ugly ways.
Yeah. I mean, and you go to those ugly spaces to research, obviously, like mm-hmm. on 4chan. Do you get in this dark headspace? I've done deep dives in those forums and felt really depressed afterwards. How do you bring yourself out of that headspace when you're like lurking for research purposes?
Crystals.
Yeah, crystals.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, I should have discovered that earlier, but no, it definitely takes a toll. I mean, I think when I was doing a video about incels a few years ago, and this one I really noticed the way that spending all this time in their forums was like my brain was getting infected by this nonsense, like this vocabulary. I mean, it's actually infected the entire culture at this point. Like we all know what a chat mm-hmm. is. They did that to us. We let it happen. It's definitely something that I'm much more cautious about. I used to be arrogant. I used to think like, oh, I won't be affected by it. But yes, I will. Everyone will. If you mm-hmm. spend time like reading hate forums, you are opening the doors of your brain and you're letting that stuff in. And you really have to be careful and keep an eye on it. Watch how much time you're spending on it. Do aftercare, you know, it's important, or it really can be like a kind of digital self-harm.
Yes, exactly that. Mm. And it was your incel video that I just recently revisited in preparation for this that really got me thinking about that and brought me back to like in lockdown. I really went there. And also after the insurrection, found myself on 4chan, 8chan, trying to get in the minds of these people. And it was really hard to shake as an empath. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a curiosity that leads you to it. Like, I think that to me, this is not a very original attribute. I think most people have a kind of morbid curiosity. That's why like true crime is so popular as a genre. All these like podcasts about serial killers, people are interested. Like there's a curiosity about the darkness. It comes from not necessarily a terrible place, right? It comes from a desire to pour light into the darkness and to know about these things. And so when you live, you know, you see like the January 6th insurrection, for example, you're like, okay, how is this happening? How did this happen? And that curiosity then leads you into like QAnon or whatever. And,
right.
you know, even if like I take it that none of us are susceptible to being persuaded by that, but still you end up just reading a lot of hateful garbage and then you're kind of carrying it with you.
Yeah. I mean, you see family members, or at least in my case, or an old friend who is what I thought was a kind nurse who is now like a raging anti-vax QAnon, question everything. Like I'm just trying to understand the people in my life who have been so radicalized, but I give up.
Yeah, I think that's like a very universal experience at this point, is that we all know people who have kind of, and I think this got about five times worse during the, you know, COVID lockdown years, as social isolation leads people into like these more and more pathological rabbit holes of like, quote, research, which often involves basically like allowing themselves to be indoctrinated by cult maniacs.
Yeah, that research. It's like confirmation bias and cults.
Yeah, and like stoking of fears and anxieties and like, I think there's like a reason why the anti-vax thing is so often a target of this. I don't know. I've been thinking about anti-vax lately. Well, the government's telling you to do it. Getting a vaccine is an injection. It's kind of an inherently invasive thing. It's like, you know, needles. There's like the penetration of your body. Like, so it's kind of not, that act itself triggers anxieties about like protecting yourself and the boundaries between your body and others, and like trust of the government in a for-profit pharmaceutical industry. Like there's anxieties there that sort of makes sense, but mm-hmm. but they're easily hijacked by charlatans, by grifters, literal grifters,
right.
Alex Jones types.
Oh, who yeah. Right.
Will kind of stoke your worst fears. Say that, yes, there is a dark agenda here, and, you know, they're harvesting adrenochrome from children and doing satanic rituals, and they're going to turn your kids gay or whatever it is now that they're worried about.
Yeah, I hope so. No.
Shh, don't tell them about the agenda.
Yeah, I feel like also, I mean, you took, how long of a break did you take from Twitter? A couple years ago.
Oh, it wasn't long. I mean, I think I was genuinely gone for like 4 or 5 months.
Okay.
I think there was a period when I was using it only to do like, you know, post videos or post, you know, interviews or other things that I'd done. Just basically use it for self-promotion, which is honestly probably the best way to use Twitter. But now, obviously on some level, I love Twitter because I can't quit. So I don't know. I guess there's just this little dopamine hit that you get from like the instant feedback of, and just like the pleasure of like blurting out your thoughts into the ether.
Yeah. I was just wondering, because like I feel like Twitter is like such a toxic place, and I like spiraled out on it a little bit, because then it was like how many of these like people that are making me mad are actually like bots or like not even real people, and then I'm like spending minutes, you know, even if it's just seconds of my day, like getting angry over something that's like not even like a real person, not even a real thought, and there's just like so much like sewage to wade through on Twitter to get to like that clever tweet from somebody that you admire to see that. So like I've been on Twitter like a lot less this past year, and I feel like my mental health has been so much better for it. So I was curious what it would be like to take like a full on 5 month break and be like, all right, I'm going back in.
I mean, I think it does waste a lot of time. I think it's good to take breaks. I'm like this week, I've been doing good at not tweeting. Trying to stay focused on the video. I don't know. I guess I ultimately end up though, when I'm away for long enough, I ultimately end up with this like FOMO, this sense of like, oh, but I need to keep up with the discourse. Like,
right. Right.
Yeah. I don't know. And on some level, I guess I live for the drama. Like I want to know like what wild stuff is going on. Because it is like, I don't know. There is like genuine fun to be had. I mean, it would have been sad, I think, if I had been away last week and I had missed like Tucker Carlson's like the end of masculinity. Like,
oh, yeah.
Like,
yes.
Like, documentary preview where he has like, what am I even seeing with my eyes?
Talk about the gay agenda.
Yeah, the gay agenda, right. This is a man who constantly is whining about like homosexuality being pushed in media, and then he makes a documentary about masculinity that has like naked lumberjacks and like UV lamps like shining at a naked man's like dick
genital
and or balls.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I don't know. Like that's you just can't make it up. It's just so good.
What was that light shining on the genitals? Like what?
So I actually don't know. I haven't done the research, but I think I can guess. There is like a fringe belief in some like manosphere internet circles, the kind of like internet man who's very concerned about his testosterone levels. There's a belief that like you need to expose the human scrotum to sunlight in order to, I mean, it's like Gwyneth Paltrow's like yonic crystals, except mm-hmm. for like reactionary, like masculinism.
Okay.
And so it's a kind of like neo-mystical, like, sort of men's move, almost like 80s, like 90s men's movement type belief that you should expose like the male genitals to sunlight to, I don't know, to rejuvenate, to charge, to increase fertility. It's not really very scientifically precise. It seems to be more on the level of putting your amethyst in the moonlight.
Right, yeah. Right.
And call it bromeopathic. Or what was it? Yeah. That's bromeopathy.
Bromeopathic, yeah.
Bro. It's testicle tanning, bro.
It's that.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just picturing all these men like hanging outside naked and being like, nuts for testosterone.
Like, yeah, like legs open at the sky. Yeah. Like,
yeah. Okay.
It's quite an image.
Yeah, you gotta be on Twitter for that stuff. I don't even tweet. I go for the drama. I can't tell you how many regional, rural disputes I've found myself going through. You know, like high school fights, like friendship fallouts. I don't know. I have no biz. I don't tweet. I just go there to scroll and mindlessly until I find something super juicy.
Do you enjoy the scrolling?
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, I don't feel great after I look at the clock and I'm like, wow, that was 3 hours gone in a flash. And now I know why everyone's mad at each other, but I still don't know why. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it's not inherently bad. As long as you find a way that brings you to happiness, then I think it's okay. For some people, that means tweeting and not reading. For other people, that means scrolling but not tweeting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're a scroller.
Yeah. I'm a voyeur. Yeah.
I have to tweet and not read because like I felt like I was seeing stuff from like liberal people in my life who I really like and respect sounding like really unhinged and being like, are you okay? Like, for example, a couple weeks ago, somebody shot up a train car in Brooklyn, and somebody I know on Twitter was like, well, I watched some of his videos and it seemed like he had some valid points. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like,
oh God.
Why? What is this empathy for the shooter? And it was just like so much of this like outpouring of like leftist empathy for the shooter. I'm like,
yeah.
I think you guys have overcorrected. I know we are abolitionists, but like this is...
Yeah, it's usually the left that's frustrating me more than the right these days on Twitter. And that I try not to get that I will lose my mind reading, and especially if it's like leftists in my life that I know and have to face soon after reading.
It's like, you know, proximity is more frustrating. You're more frustrated by what your neighbor is doing than by what's on the other side of town. Like, and it's also just, I don't know. You want to think that like people who are sort of in your vague political camp are not gonna act like psychos. So when they do, it's like, I don't know. There's like an element of like cringe, like you're embarrassing us. And then there's also just like, I don't know. When I see people, on the left, like doing wild stuff, like, I don't know, having so much sympathy for mass shooters that it's like not there to like, I don't know, people who are in jail for drug possession or whatever. Yeah, it does like fill me with a sense of doom. Like, oh, it's hopeless. Okay.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit now about parasocial relationships. How has your experience in terms of like starting out with, I'm guessing, a decent sized following, and then is I feel like a lot of them start when people kind of get in early, right, on a creator. They're like a fan from the beginning, and you're like, oh, this is really cool. This person wants to interact with me, like through social media. I'll talk to them, and then like as you grow. And then they seem to attach more. I mean, maybe that's not always the case, but I feel like that's kind of my understanding of how parasocial relationships
usually form. Too.
Yeah. I mean, like nobody is sending, you know, Jennifer Aniston a DM and she's engaging at this point, you know, but like had social media been around, like right when she was taking off, parasocial relationships would have been more of an issue for her.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if she's responding to the DM, that's the point actually where it sort of stops being parasocial because there actually is a reciprocity.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, I guess I think I actually messed up the definition of parasocial relationship.
Well, it's really confusing.
Yeah. Let's define it.
I guess it's hard to define. There's so much discourse about this that I feel like it's kind of a little bit overused of a term. Well, maybe not overused, but people do kind of talk about parasocial relationships like it's this inherently pathological thing, like it's abnormal, and actually I think it's like almost universal. I think let's just try this out as a definition and see if it works. Like maybe a parasocial relationship, it's a unbalanced relationship where there's an illusion of intimacy between a spectator and a performer, where the spectator feels like they have a personal relationship with the performer, but it's that illusion is maintained by them seeing the performer, you know, and seeing the performance, but the performer doesn't actually know the spectator. They don't know anything about them. It's just generic audience from the performance, from the perspective of the performer. But each individual spectator kind of feels like they're developing a personal relationship, and they have, you know, social feelings for this person that sort of resemble the feelings that you might have for your friends. I think it's totally normal to have some level of this. Like I watch YouTubers. The YouTubers I really like, and I've listened to hours and hours of their content. Like, I'm not delusional. I understand they don't know me and they don't know me personally, but I still feel this kind of sense of intimacy of knowing this person. And I think that, I don't know, anyone who listens to podcasts probably has some of this, right? If you're listening to a podcast in your car, you sort of feel like you're in a room with people and you're hanging out, like you're talking to friends, you know, it's this illusion. So I don't think that's inherently bad, but it can kind of become bad when people get overly dependent on parasocial relationships, or they become delusional and feel like they're entitled to reciprocity that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Like I have gotten emails. We've gotten emails from people who live in areas where they don't know anybody who's queer. And they'll say, you know, I feel like you two are my only queer friends. And I think, like, good. I hope you can consider that's better than you feeling like you have zero queer friends. Like, yeah. If you feel like we're there for you, you know, once a week, and we provide like some feelings of like comfort and joy for you, that's great. Like, I think that that's a really cool thing that we do. And I guess when we had like a smaller following, I didn't realize like maybe how problematic it was, but one time, and I'm sure they're like the nicest of people, early on was invited to somebody's wedding. And I thought, like, wouldn't that be crazy if we just like went to their wedding?
Like, it'd only get crazier after that.
I know. We didn't end up going, and this was with my like previous co-host, but I'm just like, what were those people thinking, like inviting us to their wedding? Like, did they really think that these like strangers were gonna come, you know?
That's when someone like the sort of sense of reciprocity becomes like they feel that you must have feelings about them because they have feelings about you,
right?
I think that this happens even more intensely for people who are queer, so I would imagine that you get a lot of this, because I think for a lot of people, being gay or being trans or being whatever letter of LGBT, like, is an experience of intense loneliness, because a lot of people, you know, there's people who don't, they live in parts of the country where it's just an inherently isolating thing. And so those people go to the internet and they look for this kind that, you know, this part of their life to be sort of validated and to be understood and to feel like that there's this connection. And so I think people form like really intense parasocial relationships with you know, especially queer creators, and like, I don't want to shame it, like you said, like, because I think, yeah, if they feel like they have two queer friends because they listen to your podcast, that's a lot better than them feeling totally alone. Like, so
right.
It's I don't want to malign that, because I think that it is valuable, but at the same time, well, let's put it this way. There's hundreds of people on the internet who call me mother. I hope I'm not breaking anyone's heart here, but I am not, in fact, their mom. And I'm not quite sure what to do with this. Sometimes I kind of play into it and I say, hello, children, you know, but I'm doing this with a sense of irony, but it makes me a little nervous because I think, you know, a lot of these people also are being kind of ironic, but sometimes irony sort of exposes a half truth where these are people who need a mother. Right. And I'm there. And so it's a point of tension, I think, for me, and something that is just sort of ambivalent. I don't think there's a clear, like, oh, this is bad or it's fine.
Right.
Like, it's complicated.
Yeah. You just sort of, I was wondering, how do we manage it? How do we deal with it? Mm-hmm. But it seems like you just tread lightly and try to self-protect and
maintain boundaries.
Yeah. But maintain boundaries that work for you. There's no clear cut way to manage this.
Yeah. And I think, well, I don't know. I think there's like more and less like ethical ways of navigating it. Like, I do think it's possible to kind of get to a point where you're sort of exploiting people, where you're like, I don't know. Sometimes I think, I guess I wish I had a good example off the top of my head, but I feel like maybe in the earlier days of YouTube, a lot of, you know, content creators who were sort of part of networks, so they were getting sort of advice or instructions, were being told explicitly, like, oh, like, always interact with your fans like they're your friends, and then get them to buy your merch, because you know what I mean, there's this kind of like, so I guess to me the more ethical way to deal with it is to sort of acknowledge you are kind of keeping people company, but you don't know them, and so there is like a boundary that needs to stay up.
I feel like I've never done it in that kind of a way that's like, oh yes, I must do this so that they give me money and like buy my, but it's always like when people interact, I'm like, oh, like, this is really sweet. I'm really thankful for the fact that they listen, and I will engage with almost, I shouldn't say this, I engage with almost anybody.
You do over engage. Yeah.
Yeah. To a point where I definitely like, probably over engage, like, you know, last night I was at a restaurant, and the waitress came over and was like, you have some fans here and they wanted me to tell you that they love your podcast and blah blah. Well, I could have just like waved and smiled. Instead, I went over, sat with them, asked them what their names were. It was one of their birthdays. I like sang happy birthday, took pictures with them, and like, you know, and it's fine. And I like doing that. But like, to a certain point, I'm like, is that too much? Am I being too much right now? Like,
I don't think so. I don't think that's inherently bad. I mean, I used to do that kind of stuff much more. Like, I actually used to be, well, much more fearless for a while. Like, I would straight up have like fan meetups where I would just,
we've
like
done that. Yeah.
It's like inconceivable now that I would do this, but I would just tweet, like, hey, I'm in Vancouver. I'm at this bar. Like, come out and say hi, you know? I mean, I've actually met people that way who like, I then went on to become like actually friends with. So.
Right. But that's the tricky thing, though, because then when that happens, because I do feel like there are a lot of listeners who I see out who are in New York, and they're patrons. And I genuinely like really like these people, and it makes me really happy to see them out. And I do like, you know, want to know what's going on in their lives and have formed a relationship. Mm-hmm. But then like, does that create hope for other people who might be a little bit more like, oh, I have a chance to be like friends with this person, which is like, no, I'm like good on friends. I don't. Like, please don't try to befriend me just because you think we're already friends from, because you know all about my life on this, you know?
Yeah, there's people, well, there's sometimes people who like feel that like, oh, you don't know it yet, but you are destined to be close to me. And sometimes that's you're destined to be my friend. Like, I just know that you would love me if you met me. And sometimes it becomes like sexual or romantic. So
yeah,
I've actually like, I'm sure this, I'm sure
we're all hot. We can't help it.
I don't know. It's really
sorry.
Hard. I'm sure that there's like some kind of, I'm sure there's like scholarship about this. And I'm sure that, I mean, I'm sure people who are doing like, you know, OnlyFans or who are doing camming talk about this too, but like, it doesn't stop a parasocial. There's also like, I think I'm the inventor of these words. Please give me credit. But like pararomantic or parasexual relationships that I think are also becoming an increasing like part of people's, a lot of people's online lives. I mean, I there's definitely people who are in my audience who like have a persistent belief that I'm going to date them once we meet.
Yeah. And
that's, I mean, that's, I think that's probably, it's delusional. I mean, I think if for people who are sex workers, part of what they're doing also is cultivating this parasocial relationship thing where in exchange for money, they're creating the illusion of erotic intimacy. And again, I think that's okay as long as everyone's like knows what's happening.
Right. They rely on that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like,
yeah,
engage, get the merch. Like, I mean, I subscribe to some people on OnlyFans and I will get, they send messages that seem very personal, but they're mass messages like, hey, baby, like,
yeah,
new exclusive video just for you, you know, and I know what's going on. I feel like I'm media literate, but I think of all of the, especially men, I don't know, people who can't make that distinction and really have those parasexual dynamics that could be like blinding. And I just don't want them to lead to any like safety issues.
Right.
Yeah. They probably have to be the most mindful.
Yeah. I think that, I'm sure, I mean, I think that's just an inherent kind of career risk there. I do think that probably most people are aware that this is a fantasy, and I think it's fine, but there's always going to be, right, there's always going to be a subset that loses that distinction.
Do you see how little faith I have in men?
Well, that's, I mean, the faith has not been
earned. They don't get it. Yeah. They don't get it.
Well, I think that, and part of that is because like they have a harder time putting themselves in the other position, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think one reason like why like men are so weird to women online is that there's like a failure of empathy, right? They don't know what it's like to have, you know, people act towards them the way they're acting. I mean, like, look, the way that like queer women are so like anxious about like, oh, I don't want to seem like predatory or weird, because it's like, you know what it's like when someone's doing that at you and you don't want to do that. But I feel like a lot of straight men in particular, like they don't have a reference point and personal experience of someone treating them like that. And so like they have no sense of when they've crossed the line.
Right.
Yeah.
They're not even worried about it.
Unless it's a gay man approaching them. Then they get it.
Yeah. But somehow they don't make a connection between that and then the way they act towards women.
Right.
Right. And then also like, I guess the sense that people are like feeling like they know you and, you know, the you that you present as counterpoints and in these videos that, you know, take a lot of time, are very thoughtful about like what's in there, what's not, like that's not a full portrait of who you are as Natalie. And then people, they just like the podcast, even though it might seem like, you know, like I think we're pretty authentic on this podcast, but it's also not like a 360 picture of who we are.
No, I overshare and I'm way more candid. And then I'll get messages like referencing and like pontificating about issues in my personal life with like unsolicited advice and diagnoses. And it's just, that's where I get uncomfortable. Like my persona is not who I am in my day to day.
Yeah. People are making like assumptions, like they know who you are.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think all of us kind of do discuss things that are somewhat fairly intimate on, you know, on our podcast, on your podcast or on my channel.
Right.
I think in a kind of paradoxical way, it's actually kind of easier to divulge your like deepest secrets to like a camera and then post it to the internet than it is to tell like your actual friends and family.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And so that I think also intensifies this sense of intimacy where like the people who feel that they know you, like, they're not entirely wrong. Like they do know a lot about you and they do know what's going on in your head.
More than my mom. Yeah.
Yeah. More than your mom. Right, exactly. But then that does get weird when they start offering feedback and it's like, wow, like this person is commenting on something that, is like super personal, and it's because I shared it online. But the fact now suddenly, like, the weirdness of me sharing that online is like highlighted by the fact that this like pretty personal thing is being like, you know, analyzed. Right.
Yes.
Yeah. But then on the flip side, and this is where I feel like I let things go too far. Like, you know, sometimes people will message me with like, hey, you mentioned that you were having like an issue with this. This is my experience with it. And like, this is just how I see it from my perspective. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is actually like really helpful. Thank you for like...
Sometimes fans are so good. I've gotten some like emails and things. They're just so insightful and smart and like grounded. Like, so it's not all like, I don't know. That's why I'm hesitant to be all super condescending about the way that we talk about parasocial relationships.
Oh, not at all. Yeah.
I think that sometimes that's the tone that people adopt. But yes, no, sometimes viewers of my channel will write in with like legitimate insight that I hadn't thought of.
Right.
And that's cool.
Yeah.
Listen, shout out to the physical therapist who helped me with my back and neck issues. Like, I got so much good feedback too. Yeah. And that like really helped me in a major way. It's case by case.
I think most of our listeners, most of our listeners, and I'm sure like most of your viewers and most of your patrons, Natalie, like you're super grateful for you. Like, they probably seem like super rad people. And then it'll just be like the occasional like person who either like feels like they're owed something, that where you start to be like, like trouble, and makes you kind of want to like retreat back or kind of question your choices.
Yeah. And I think like, I don't know, often this discussion, I feel like the people who end up like getting anxious about, oh, are they crossing the line? Like, so often it's always like the people who need to worry least who are worrying the most.
Yes. Exactly. Like, yes. Yes. If you're listening to this and you're like, are they talking about me? Yeah. No,
probably
no.
Not. Yeah.
It's the person who like does not see it.
Yeah. Right. Who's like, no, I'm definitely not crossing a line. Like,
they need this.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause no, sometimes I'll get messages from people who's like, it's like, hey, like, I don't want to be too parasocial and I really hope that I'm not like blah, 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 but I just like your channel. And it's like, you're not being too parasocial, it's fine. And then there's a person who's not at all worried about that, who's just speeding over the lines.
Yeah.
Well, you keep us posted if you figure out any best practices.
I mean, same. Like, it's I think it's just a constant. Well, hey, what do you think about this? Do you ever feel like a kind of reverse, like, parasocial relationship, like, to the audience? Because I feel like that's something that I have experienced, where like I actually find myself developing feelings for the idea of the audience, like, in a way that's, I don't know, like, sometimes I'll post like a picture, this is an embarrassing thing to admit, but like, I'll post a picture to Instagram or whatever, and like, there'll be all these comments being like, wow, you're so beautiful, and you're so amazing, and you say, and like, it fills me with this like genuine like warmth, as if I'm actually being loved by a person. Yeah. And then that feels good, but then I'll like step back for a second, I'll be like, that's weird, I'm having like this borderline like sensual experience with a crowd of anonymous strangers, like,
for sure.
What do we do with that, like,
Roxy Hart?
Right.
It's like, yeah. And they love me for loving them, and I love them for loving me.
And the love is like, and on some level the love is real, like there's like a real emotional like, dimension to it.
Yeah, that's real.
Right.
Or like, we'll mention some random like offhand comment and be like, oh no, well, we already mentioned this, surely you guys remember, like, just something so like to the minutia we obsess over. I'm like, they remember everything we say, and they'll know.
Right.
You know?
Right. We put a lot of expectations
the
on.
Whole time we've been talking for days.
Meanwhile, somebody will be like, oh, I can't believe you haven't talked about like this thing. I'm like, we just talked about that for like 20 minutes. And they're like, really? I just listened to that episode. I was like, okay, maybe people aren't listening like we think they are.
No, they're not in the edit bay. Like,
no.
Like, really on the replay with it.
Right.
Except sometimes they are. Like, I don't know. I've had this experience sometimes like meeting people who watch my videos, and like, they know my videos way better than I do. Like,
oh yeah.
They'll be like quoting my own videos at me, and I'll be like, does sound familiar, but I don't remember when I said that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, especially, like, we put out weekly episodes, so some people will, like, say a quote, and I'm like, oh, which one of us said that? Like, what was the context?
Oh, I don't rarely remember what I say, and it will be quoted back to me, like, in my DMs. I don't know. I did have to talk myself down from welcoming you onto the podcast. We're going like, hey, sweaty, and just like parroting back things you
hey,
say.
Hey, gorge. On- yeah. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Let us begin. Like, I don't know. Like, just hurling impressions at you. I was like, don't do it. But then I just did it.
Well, what's funny is, like, I don't know, because I feel like on my YouTube channel, like, obviously I'm much more, like, sort of, like, relaxed version of myself now, but, like, in my videos, I feel like I'm being so theatrical, but, like, people, that doesn't seem to decrease people's sense that they know an authentic person, right?
Right,
they,
yeah.
Like, yeah. They just, like, sort of take the theatricality at face value.
Like, you're Oscar Wilde in your day-to-day.
Yeah, that's what they think, but wouldn't that be yeah. annoying? I don't know. I feel like I would be annoying if I was like that all the time.
Like, you throw a supper party and yeah. like that, so you're just sitting there in a chair when everybody like, arrives.
Like, yeah, like orating. I don't know. I think I'm glad I'm not like that all the time. I think it would be annoying, but I do sometimes feel like I'm a disappointment to people who have seen my videos first, because I don't know, they're expecting someone who's like a little bit more I don't know, oratorical than I actually am. Like, I'm yeah. a pretty shy person in real life.
One last question for you. What is one part of straight culture that you like to appropriate?
Ooh.
If you could pick anything.
Any part of straight culture. the shamelessness of it.
Yes.
I would say. Ooh. Yeah. That... The lack
That's
of
great.
Self-consciousness in public. I would love to be able to appropriate that.
Yes. Wow. That's the best answer. We shouldn't even ask this anymore. What a great answer.
All done.
We do need to wrap up, but I'm curious, where can people follow you and watch your videos?
Well, I'm ContraPoints on YouTube, or Natalie Nguyen. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. And ContraPoints on Patreon for crowdfunding. And that's basically it.
Thank you so much for taking the time to dike out with us. This was a lot of fun.
Such
Thank
a delight.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was a lot of fun.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts, with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz. And how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.